Malcolm Holmes, schedule for Malcolm. We don't know yet if we'll be able to present the weekly update next Friday. Malcolm will let us know early in the week, so stay tuned for that. We might have the final message before Pesach, literally right before Pesach. Obviously, Shvi Shel Pesach, there will be no weekly update. And then Malcolm's in Europe the week after Pesach, and it looks like he will be able to be in contact and update us regarding the events of that week. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be with you, as always.
I appreciate that very much. We'll start with what happened last week. While we were not doing a weekly update last Friday, we weren't able to address it. What is the latest? What do we know about the killer, the murderer, and his possible accomplices, those responsible for the attack in Toulouse, France?
Well, as you know, I always discuss here after many of the incidents the fact that the immediate reaction here and abroad is to say it's a lone gunman, that it's not part of a network, that there's nobody else involved. He find out then that he goes to Pakistan to train. He goes to other places. He's under the influence of groups that he's considered a prince of the Islamist movement in France, that his cousin is one of the leaders of one of the extremist radicals, that his, not his cousin, it's actually his mother's husband's son, or the reverse. And, I mean, more and more connections. And now the French police announced that they arrested more than 20 people overnight, part of the network of these terrorists or radical extremists, and that there's obviously much more to it. His brother was involved in the purchase of the motorcycle, and that a third person was involved. So we see that this is not a lone gunman, that there's always a connection. There's a connection to a mosque, to a training period, to others. And especially in France, we have seen how far the radical infrastructure, and I think that people ought to go back and look at the hearings recently held by Congressman Peter King of Long Island, who is very courageous and who has been under great scrutiny and criticism because of his efforts to hold these hearings, exposing Hezbollah, the testimony of Mitch Silver, who's head of the Department of Intelligence or Research at the NYPD, where he exposes Hezbollah's activities in New York. And to think that what happened in France can happen here is a huge mistake.
Right.
It goes back to the need for security in our institutions. It goes back to the need for alert and for people being alert in institutions, taking the necessary steps and going to the ScanUSA website, scnusa.org website, to get instructions and ideas and very detailed directions on what they can do. But it's amazing to see the descriptions and about the things that were prevented. And when we see the linkages, the global linkages of all of these groups and Hezbollah's activities being in the forefront of what they're doing. And in fact, we just found out over the last couple of days something I discussed on the show a couple of weeks ago about the deterioration in Yemen, despite the newspaper reports about the agreements and how far they're progressing. And now it seems that Hezbollah and Hamas are the front line of Iran's activities there, and together with al-Qaeda taking part of it in the south and active amongst the secessionists in the south, they're using Hezbollah in the north with the Houthis, which is a direct threat to the Arabian Peninsula, meaning the Gulf countries and Saudi Arabia.
It's sometimes difficult for regular folks around the world to understand that episodes like the one in France are connected to what you just described.
It's all connected, and the point is that Iran has established through Hezbollah probably in 20 or 30 countries a presence. We know that they were in Mexico, according to testimony before Congress, and there's at least 21 Hezbollah-linked cases that were prosecuted by Justice Department since over the last decade, and that means that there are many more that we didn't get, and there are others that were prevented, and maybe not the linkage, direct linkage to Hezbollah established. But we know that when the police take the preventative steps of having an effective monitoring unit and having the ability to go into the places where often these extremists and potential murderers and potential terrorists or terrorists are operating, and then they come under the kind of criticism and unyielding criticism, whether from CARE or groups that themselves have been associated or alleged to have been associated with terrorist groups, and the individuals, including members of Congress, calling for an investigation of them when they're doing exactly what they should be doing and protecting us.
If we analyze other high-profile cases, Seattle, JCC, Brooklyn Bridge, will we also find that this is that those are not lone gunman situations, or those may be exceptions?
There may be exceptions, but it's very rare. Who trains them? Who inspires them? Who incites them?
Right.
Who tells them this, even if it's somebody who's unbalanced? Why is it this the way they give expression to it? And yes, I do think, and you know, the information came out on Nebuch Ari Halberstam, Zichron Lebracha's killer, was in fact gunning for a Jew. He's admitted it now. I mean, it's come out.
From Manhattan.
18 years later.
Right. He was targeting the van as it left the hospital.
But he was targeting Jews.
Right.
He said he was looking for a Jewish target, and even beyond the specific van, you know, something that was denied and people don't want to admit it for whether it can be political reasons or reasons that are legitimate of not wanting to stir a population or create fear or hurt tourism or whatever else. No, this is something you have to tell people, you have to deal with and confront directly. And frankly, it's the interest of the Muslim community, the vast majority of whom are not involved in this, and for them to do it because they're also a target and because it hurts their entire community. And when they did against in the Irish community against the IRA, you didn't see this kind of reaction, or JDL even, or other groups that were investigated by FBI and police and stuff like that. When there was a legitimate grounds for concern, people understood it. But here, anything they do, and it intimidates and therefore prevents law enforcement from being effective.
You know, another thing, by the way, the media jumps all over the reason why the gunman did it. In other words, you know, the gunman or the note that he leaves or the video they leave behind, whatever the case may be. In this case, it was, you know, Palestinian children who are murdered by Israelis. And the media just takes that and splashes it everywhere as if it's legitimate, as if it's a newsworthy item.
No, but it's not even true because he says that he was out to get another policeman, another soldier, and explain, how is it possible that a guy could go and kill three soldiers? And there was hardly a reaction. It was only after he attacked the school. Why didn't they arrest him right away? They knew about this guy. It would not should not have been that hard to trace the people in Toulouse who you know, were under scrutiny or had in the past been scrutinized or identified. Why is it that after murder of three soldiers, they didn't do anything or did very little?
Yeah. Any other final message on this point to the people in this area who are wondering about the security? I know you're going to talk about the network and other things, but you know, we know that the NYPD and other organizations like that have been very effective, and intelligence is usually the key, you know, stopping things before they happen, so to speak. Anything to say as we approach the big holiday regarding our Jewish institutions?
Never take our freedom and our security for granted. Never believe it can't happen, and that something can't happen anywhere, that we have to be vocal in our support for those who are protecting us, and to do our part, and especially in advance of Yontif, there are briefings. I know the police will have extra presence, but Pesach is highly visible, and, you know, we had the Pesach massacre 1 year in Israel, and yeah, there have been other things
10 years ago
this time, and it's very important that no one take it for granted. Every shul, every school has to take extra precautions, and there are simple things they can do. There are more complicated things they can do depending upon the resources, but there's no excuse for doing nothing.
How's the and before I ask about Land Day, I just want to mention there is a rally today, folks, 12 noon, Israeli Consulate 42nd and 2nd in support of Israel on what is being called the Land Day and the Global March to Jerusalem. By the enemy, 12 noon today, 42nd and 2nd at the Israeli consulate. So how has the global march to Jerusalem been so far, Mr. Homeline?
Not significant so far. There were clashes at Kalandia where Palestinians threw stones at soldiers. This is near Beit Lechem, as you know, Bethlehem. And they announced the closures of the West Bank was closed off for 24 hours, and there's limited access to Har Bayit, and they're particularly focused to prevent access in the Lebanese border area.
Right.
Last year, Syria was a major concern.
Right. Land Day gets a lot of publicity in advance, you know?
Well, they are very capable of manipulating the situations like this, and they have, in this case, PLO and Hamas urge participation. They have a number of high-profile people, including Reverend Wright, the former minister of the president, and many others in Great Britain. People identified with being anti-Israel joined in supporting, even Bishop Tudu, the demonstrations. And, you know, they won't be held to account afterwards if there's any violence, because they instigate these people, and there have been all sorts of caravans, and then they couldn't get through some countries. Right now, the, quote, million men is not, march is not materializing. We don't know whether they will try to rush the borders in Gaza, along Gaza, or across the, from the Yehudah and Shomron into Israel. We know that there are people who are trying to instigate violence, who want to draw attention and create circumstances where Israel will have to retaliate. But and it's a good diversion. We know that Iran has given the money for this and been funding this. It is not. It's very early in the day yet, so this is not over. My hope is that Israel was well prepared. We tried not to give it too much advance publicity, not to build it up.
Well, others took care of that.
Well, I don't think it got that much. No, it didn't get much
really
coverage yet.
My email box was filled with Global March on Jerusalem this week.
Well, yeah, because some people were sending it out. Now, we alerted people to it. We sent out emails to tell people and give them the background that if, God forbid, something goes wrong today, people are prepared to respond to it. But I think it has not gotten the public attention. You know, you don't see movies of the people organizing and stuff. It was done in Europe at some places.
I wonder why they have so much trouble recruiting. What does it say about the regular folks on the other side, you know?
Well, I do think it says a lot, and I think it says a lot about where people's minds are at now and how this can be manipulated by people, how Iran, there are reports that Iran demanded that a dozen Jews lead the march, the part that goes into Syria and go to the border, because they said the Israelis won't shoot at the Jews coming there. We don't know if that is in fact the case right now. We're having a hard time establishing the fact, but this report was pretty widespread, and I got it from members of the Iranian community who usually have good access to information.
Boy, that's a good strategy, huh?
Well, it's a dangerous strategy, and it reminds us why that Iranian Jews could be potential hostages in other circumstances and that they should get out.
Yeah. You've told them that directly, or as
Many
directly as directly as you can, right?
And as this show has enabled us in other vehicles, and the Iranian community has tried, I understand why people are reluctant. It seems to be human nature that Jews and others in circumstances like this, where it should be obvious what needs to be done.
Oh, I've spoken to Iranian Jewish residents of the New York area. I've spoken to them directly, who have zero influence on their family when they beg them to leave. It's unbelievable. Malcolm Holmline with us. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. So, and we'll get to the Kadima Party, folks. Don't worry. I will get to it. So it's the United States Supreme Court that's now ruled that lower courts get to decide about this whole Jerusalem on the passport issue?
Essentially, just to remind people, this is the Zivotofsky case, where a young boy born to the Zivotofsky family gets passport Jerusalem, no Israel, therefore virtually stateless. And it's an issue that has come up over and over again. And Moynihan, even Senator Moynihan, of blessed memory, who passed the legislation on Jerusalem many years ago, but it's been waived constantly by George Bush and President Obama, saying that the statue intruded on the presidential prerogative in terms of foreign policy. And here you have a ruling of 8-1.
Yeah.
That is pretty definitive. And what it says, it essentially refers it back to the lower court and say that they made a mistake when they refused to weigh in on the case when they deemed it to be a political question.
It seems like a cop-out. Is this a regular Supreme Court move?
I mean, like... No, but the court itself didn't want to rule on it because it said that the lower court had to make a decision. and it's about whether U.S. passports for citizens born in Jerusalem should, upon their request, identify the place of birth as Israel, when in many other countries that is, in fact, what people can do. And the six of the justices held that the political question doctrine doesn't apply where a statute conveys a clear right to individuals, meaning when the law allows a person to make such a demand, then the political issue is irrelevant. And we have to credit Nat Lewin and others, and our Lawfare Project filed an amicus brief, but he really, and he and Elisa really took the lead. And there were many people who were skeptical. I know many people emailed me and said, this is a bad move, it's going to rule against us, and it'll make it worse. And here you see that...
But it's not a ruling.
It's not a victory.
Right.
But it is a partial clarification, at least, and could pave the way for a positive...
Well, you would need a courageous lower court, courageous, judicious minds to go ahead and rule that way in this case.
Well, no. If they now recognize that this is not a political issue and... say that the Congress is the fact that Congress passed the law. I think that
there's no other
a lot of sense to pass to say that it's legitimate for a person because you're allowed to do it in other circumstances.
Right. And, I mean, first of all, not everything that makes sense happens in a courtroom.
That's true.
But
or anywhere else these days.
Right. But still, it's a I don't know. I mean, I still think it'll take some courage. But let's see what happens. I mean, we'll know now when once some lower court makes this next decision. Right.
Right.
That'll be interesting to watch. The State Department official who had trouble deciding whether Jerusalem was the capital of Israel or not. Did you read the transcript of that exchange?
Yes.
So
one of the more regrettable exchanges, I think, the administration's perspective.
Okay. You're now an advisor to that State Department official. How would you advise them to answer?
Well, first of all, the answer is not to say that our embassy is in Tel Aviv, therefore implying that that's our capital, that we recognize it. And it clearly she was not prepared. There's a woman, Newland, who was a deputy spokesman or something at the State Department. The questions came up vis-a-vis the court ruling. And rather than say we'll wait till the outcome of the court ruling, saying that we don't prejudge it, said that Jerusalem is a final status issue. Well, Jerusalem is a final status issue, the reporter says, but what about West Jerusalem? You recognize West Jerusalem, don't you?
Right.
And instead of saying, yes, we recognize it, but it's, the final borders, whatever, will be final status, she said, well, essentially that would refuse to recognize it and refused to then made a reference to the fact, well, our embassy is in Tel Aviv, as if that's the capital that we recognize.
Yeah, but...
And there's much more. First of all, I think it's essential that they issue a clarification. I think...
A clarification that includes that West Jerusalem is recognized as the capital or something short of that?
Well, the American officials visit in West Jerusalem. The American officials, of course, they recognize Israel's status in West Jerusalem. There's no question about that.
If the United States officially recognized West Jerusalem as the capital, the embassy would be there.
No, they don't move the capital, the embassy, because they're saying this is contingent on the final resolution.
Right, which means that
of Jerusalem. They did buy land. America bought land in Jerusalem to move an embassy.
I know, but if it is in all, me to defend the State Department.
Why? What is this? What happened here?
I understand. See what happens when you don't speak to me for 2 weeks. But you see, the point is that it's not fair to them in that. If the capital, even though there's a purchase of land and a recognition of West Jerusalem, if the United States and the White House are going to spend all these decades denying that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, you can't go ahead as a State Department spokesman all of a sudden and say that West Jerusalem is the capital of Israel.
No, but her answer seemed to deny that we recognize it. And the answer is that we do not deny it. The United States doesn't say that when there's a resolution that Israel's capital won't be in West Jerusalem. What they're saying is that Palestinians want a right to have a Jerusalem capital in Jerusalem as well, and that nobody knows where the dividing line will be. That was the question and it was resolved when we passed overwhelmingly in the Congress of the United States in 1995, I think. The law that says Jerusalem is the capital is recognized as the capital of Israel. That's the law of the land. And the detail, frankly, as I point out many times, if every presidential candidate promises us an embassy. We'd have 40 embassies already in Jerusalem if all of them
at least
lived up to the, promises. And by the way,
knowing the Jewish world, we need 40 embassies.
Because we're not going to that embassy. That's so
exactly. Oh, boy. Would the President of the United States answered any differently? Would he have said what you just said?
I think he would have been more judicious in his response, but given his comments to Medvedev, he raises questions also, and I think...
He tells the President of Russia that there will be he'll have more flexibility on items like the missile defense system, etc., after the election. Well, we already have a clue. What do you think of that statement by the President?
Well, I'm sure there's nobody regrets it more than he does, having said it, but not knowing that the mic would pick it up. It's not something that he said purposely.
Boy, you got to watch MSNBC. They explained why it's no big deal at all.
Yeah, see, this is part of the problem. You know, in an election year, those who want to find excuses for everybody find them. And I'm not saying, you know, I think that the president should address it and just, and I'm sure that it'll be used. That clip will be played over and over again in ads, either by the campaigns or by the super campaigns or whatever, the super PACs. But, you know, it scares people to think, and it may not have this implication, but it scares people to think that if this is, that if the issues are being put on hold now until after the election, and then make a completely different policy. And this is a very sensitive issue about the missiles, especially at a time when the Russians are consistently going against America's interests, America's policy, whether it's Syria, whether it's Iran, whether many other issues. We have to work with Russia, but I think to imply that somehow we'll make deals with them after November, it sends the wrong signal, certainly when we have the P5+1 talks coming up on Iran, many other things that are coming up that are of great significance.
Future of the world is all hinging upon waiting till after the election. It's like in Israel, you know, acharei chagim. Yeah, everything's got to wait till after the election. It's unbelievable that we've gotten to this point.
Unbelievable, and I don't think it's only one president. I think, you know, everybody.
Yeah, it's every president, right?
Say the same things after January 21st as they said before November, the first week is Tuesday in November.
Right. We're going to get to Kadima in a minute. I got to ask you about this. Thank you to Drudge, who alerted me and his millions of other readers to this one. Foreignpolicy.com, Israel's secret staging ground. U.S. officials believe that the Israelis have gained access to air bases in Azerbaijan, giving them one step closer to a war with Iran. Now, Malcolm, first question. When I read this, I said to myself, when was the last time you were in Azerbaijan?
I refuse to answer on the grounds that I couldn't. No, I was there a number of years ago. I was planning a visit, but it's a number of years.
You were planning a visit, or somebody in Israel was planning a visit for you?
Dropping us in.
Well, I'm just wondering.
Look, the Azeris have denied the story. I think this was a purposeful leak by somebody. Because if it's true, it was meant to sabotage it. If it isn't true, it just puts Azerbaijan, which is in a very sensitive position.
Northern border of Iran, folks. Look at the map.
And there are more Azeris living in Iran than living in Azerbaijan.
Really?
Azeris means people from Azerbaijan. And the border there is virtually open. I mean, you're talking about, I think, 20 to 30 million Azeris in Iran. If you remember, Iranian agents or backed agents try to blow up the Israeli embassy, try to take out, carry out a terrorist attack just a couple of weeks ago. And the president has been very courageous in maintaining close ties with Israel, with the United States, and yet being a neighbor of Iran. Iran has targeted Azerbaijan many times and considers it a very weak or perhaps threatening presence. And therefore, this report about four abandoned Air Force bases being made available to Israel can only be put out to sabotage what Israel plans.
A senior administration official said the Israelis have bought an airfield, and the airfield is called Azerbaijan.
This goes to another question that's been raised by many people, and if you look at a number of commentators talk about the leaks that appear to be coming on a regular basis from different people associated with the administration or sources, unnamed sources, whether it's the war games about Iran or about the Israel's plans or about the negative impact or potential damage to the United States of an Israeli action, and it all seems to be meant to undermine support and to harm the whatever it is that Israel has planned, if they have something planned. And the speculation in a lot of these articles is that this is a deliberate campaign. I can't verify it. I don't know. I don't know who leaked the story, but it is attributed to a senior administration official. And what interest anybody would have in putting that out, other than to invite violence on Azerbaijan and more tension, and to assure that Azerbaijan won't let Israel use a base.
Israel. So if you're going to be carrying a message to Baku, you will not be revealing it on this show, you're saying?
If I had a message, I would not be revealing it.
Israel's deepening relationship with the Baku government, Baku is Azerbaijan, was cemented in February by a $1.5 billion arms agreement that provides Azerbaijan with sophisticated drones and missile defense systems. At the same time, Baku's ties with Tehran have frayed. Iran presented a note to Azerbaijan's ambassador last month claiming that Baku has supported Israeli-trained assassination squads targeting Iranian scientists, an accusation the Azeri government called a slander.
Right.
This month, Baku announced 22 people have been arrested for spying on behalf of Iran. A lot of fodder on the other side of this debate.
There is, and it, you know, it fits a certain pattern. Look, the Iranians are busy praising the Syrians for the way that they've handled the crisis there. Again, yesterday, they're under a lot of pressure. They're moving now towards the talks that are coming up, which some people report that there is some sort of an understanding amongst the P5, the Permanent Five, and Germany. With Russia, including Russia, that they're going to let Iran enrich at a low level, that Iran is going to again use the talks to buy time, as we know that they never do it to really implement any agreement, but they do it to just obfuscate and lie. It's interesting that Erdogan and Ahmadinejad, Erdogan of Turkey and Ahmadinejad, just a few days after Erdogan met with the president in South Korea, yesterday held a press conference in which they denounced Western arrogance, a term that we have heard before, and that Erdogan is the one who carried a message to Tehran, supposedly about the agreement. The UK yesterday, England, the foreign minister, spoke about limiting sanctions or easing sanctions if Iran cooperates. So we're already seeing the softening of the ground towards such an outcome. We know that Iran is not going to stop its nuclear program. We know that they are continuing to expand their activities, terrorism support, their support for Syria. I mean, there are just so many aspects to the to Iran's activities. Its executions up 400% domestically, and we're heading for talks on April 13th. And I'm concerned that in fact we may see some sort of a gesture. The administration keeps talking about engagement, says that they're going to seriously pursue diplomacy. If diplomacy could really work, fine. If they could really dismantle the nuclear program, that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no evidence that that really could be the case. And so you have more sanctions being introduced on the one hand, but all these rumors and you know, we know not to take them too seriously, and we know that this is a political year and everybody exploits everything, but it's not to be dismissed. And the failure of the world in the face of Syria, now the same thing there with Kofi Annan's six-point plan. I mean, it's a sham. It's a sham. It's legitimizing Assad. He will stay. At the very least, he buys time. The opposition there is becoming more and more Islamist. We see even the shootings, the defections, the other things going on, the dissatisfaction, the number of killed expanding every day.
They're not under a ceasefire, despite what the media says.
21 were killed yesterday, on Thursday, according to the reports that came in. And we know the economic situation is bad. Their oil exports, Iran is helping them export to China. But unemployment, they admit at 36%. A couple of weeks ago, they said it was 11%. And the cut in pay of those who are working is about 50%.
Right.
So the economy is in ruins, but they don't care, neither there nor Iran, about the consequences for the people. This is an ideologically driven thing, driven also by self-perpetuation. The Syrian Orthodox Church said that in homes, that 90% of the Christians had to flee. That's more than 50,000 people. Where's the headline about it? Where's the talk of ethnic cleansing of Christians in Syria as a result of these of the government activities there, where they told people you either leave or you're shot? They went door to door in many of these places. They killed 200 in February. Whole families were killed, and yet we hear about reports that are being written about the Christians in Israel, and this kind of a blatant violations go unmentioned.
All right, we have Rabbi Yudin with the Shabbos HaGadol message coming up. We'll get to it in a minute, folks. I got to ask, as I've been saying the entire time, about the Kadima primary, an overwhelming victory, to say the least, for Mofaz over Livni. Is it a referendum on Mofaz and his popularity, or is it a referendum on Livni, how people are fed up with her?
Well, I do think it was very personal about Tzipi Livni. You could say if it was a 51-49 vote that maybe it was over some issue or something, but here you have a 2-1 vote. I mean, she got less than 40%, and he got 60-some percent. It was predictable, although there were many people thought in the end it would not change. And you have less than half of the Kadima members voting, which is normal in this kind of a situation.
Right.
But it's
part
of the political turmoil. And now you see all the talk of her joining one party, another party, switching parties. Who's the beneficiary? Does Kadima now really go down on Yachimovich, leaving Labor to 18 mandates, and they would become the leading opposition party, and all of them acknowledging that Israel's coalition is very strong. I mean, Bibi's coalition is very strong in Israel. It is really a tumultuous situation there, and I think anybody who can assert what the real reality is, what's clear is that Bibi is in a very strong position. There doesn't seem to be somebody who will lead the opposition to a victory, but you have Yair Lapid, you have many others coming into the situation. It is shifting sand.
It's, say the least, unbelievable. Fascinating, as usual, in Israel. And people did think, as we got closer to that primary, that it would be a much closer election. But that never, to her chagrin, that never materialized.
It's true, and I think that she did not work the crowds and the membership in the way that they wanted, and the feeling that Kadima was slipping, and that new leadership at Mofaz, as a former chief of staff and head of the Minister of Defense, that he would bring a certain credibility. But you see his positions that he's advocating now are very critical of Bibi and criticizing his positions on Iran, saying he's using this as a diversion. Many people thought that he, in fact, would bring the party into the Bibi government, and that he would be less contentious a party to the current government. We'll have to see.
Right. All right, Malcolm. You'll let us know about next week whether we'll speak Erev Pesach or not. Meanwhile, enjoy your Shabbat HaGadol.
I don't. Happy matzahs to everybody. But in Mitzvah Shem, I hope we'll be able to do it.
All right, Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Friday morning, we call it the weekly update here at JM in the AM.